time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhizkar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Crowds of mourners attend a funeral ceremony in the Iranian capital for a member of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps who was assassinated on Sunday. Israel defies an international outcry over the recent killing of a Palestinian journalist, saying there is no suspicion of criminal activity. Plus, political crisis deepening in Tunisia. The labor union prepares for a nationwide strike after rejecting a national dialogue proposed by the president. Good to have you with us. Happening in the Iranian capital, Tehran, at this moment, a funeral procession is underway for a member of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps who was assassinated 2 days ago. Hundreds of mourners are attending the event. Many are holding pictures of late Colonel Hassan Sayyed Khodai and chanting slogans against the United States and Israel. Khodai was assassinated just outside of his home in an eastern Tehran neighborhood. He was shot 5 times by 2 motorcyclists. The IRGC has called his killing an act of terrorism. IRGC's commander, Major General Hossein Salami, has pledged to avenge Khodai's assassination, saying the response will be tough and make the enemies regret their heinous crime. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has returned home from his groundbreaking visit to Oman. Raisi says the visit opened a new chapter in the two countries' relations. Let's see what else he had to say about the visit.
We don't have much economic relations, and over the past couple of months, our business relations has doubled and stands at over $1 billion. But we believe that there's a lot of potential in order to develop these relations further. And as far as business relations are concerned, both countries and high-ranking officials of the two countries have signed MOUs in order to develop business and economic relations. In short, 13 MOUs and agreements were signed by the high-ranking officials of Iran and Oman And this is considered a new page and a new chapter in our relations. Of course, we did have agreements that were signed before, but what really matters is for these agreements to be implemented. And of course, one issue that was brought up is that these MOUs are not implemented. So this trip is considered a beginning of a new era in order to start implementing these MOUs. The basic pillar of these agreements are mostly regarding fiscal cooperation and also health tourism. Another issue that is important is that the bilateral relations between Iran and Oman can help strong regional relations, and good relations between the two countries can increase cooperation in the region, which was discussed in this meeting and all of the meetings that we had with high-ranking Omani officials. And we are pursuing stronger relations both with Oman and in the region.
Earlier, we were joined by the chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajari. He says the relationship between Iran and Oman has served as a pillar of security and stability for waterways in the Persian Gulf region.
And that relationship has served both Oman and Iran, and indeed has actually been a pillar of stability and security for the waterways, as was mentioned before, and the whole of the Persian Gulf region. And that is an exactly one of the reasons why this should be indeed extended elsewhere among the neighbors in the Persian Gulf region. And those who are refusing to go down this route or creating obstacles, they're only serving a very twisted interest of people outside the region. And they're not, say, serving the interest of the region or regional countries or indeed international safety and security and benefit to region and beyond. And so, therefore, it really just makes sense. I mean, the example of Oman is really a great reason why it should be extended elsewhere.
Rescuers are working hard to help people trapped under the rubble of a building that collapsed in Iran's southwestern city of Abadan. The incident has claimed the lives of 10 people. There are fears that a number of casualties could rise, with reports saying up to 50 people remain trapped under the debris. Some 29 people have been pulled from the 10-story building that came down on Monday. The collapse has blocked the city's busiest road, with surrounding buildings evacuated. An investigation is underway into the cause of the incident. The building's owner and contractor are in detention. Defying the international outcry over the recent killing of a Palestinian journalist, Israel says there is no immediate suspicion of criminal activity in the case. The regime's military advocate says even if an Israeli soldier had fatally shot Shireen Abu Akleh, the soldier cannot be held guilty of criminal misconduct. The advocate says the death of the journalist in the midst of an active combat zone doesn't warrant a criminal investigation. The regime's military advocate is responsible for determining whether any soldier would face disciplinary action for the incident. On May the 11th, Abu Akleh was shot and killed while covering an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank flashpoint city of Jenin. Her death drew strong international condemnation for the Tel Aviv regime. Qatar-based Al Jazeera network, for which Abu Akleh was reporting, has accused Israel of killing her, quote, deliberately and in cold blood. Hamas has held a national conference in the Gaza Strip to mark the victory of the Gaza-based Palestinian resistance factions against Israel during the 11-day war in May 2021. Ashraf Shannon has more details in the following report.
Hundreds of Palestinians attended a national conference in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the first anniversary of the victory of Palestinian resistance against the Israeli regime in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. The Gaza-based resistance groups, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, fired more than 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli aggressions on Palestinians in Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. During the battle, Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. Addressing the conference via satellite, the head of the Political Bureau of Hamas movement, Ismail Haniyeh, warned the Israeli regime against holding the so-called flag march in Al-Quds.
The Zionist enemy must understand that the Sword of Al-Quds battle will be a walk in the park compared to any future battles with Palestinian resistance groups. The Zionists must not test our patience, and they must stop their provocations, especially in Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians believe that the Sword of Al-Quds battle has united their ranks. During the 11-day war, all Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip worked together through the joint Bureau of military operations.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinians were united together against the Israeli forces. The Sword of Al-Quds battle exposed the weakness of the Israeli regime. The Palestinian people in Gaza, in Al-Quds, and in the occupied West Bank will always fight for their rights.
Palestinian resistance groups have been holding military maneuvers following the Sword of Al-Quds battle to confront any new Israeli war amid the increasing warmongering rhetoric by the Israeli regime.
Observers say that Palestinian resistance groups fought a fierce battle against the Israeli regime last year, forcing Tel Aviv to declare a unilateral ceasefire. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Tunisia's political crisis deepening. The country's labor union rejects the president's proposed national dialogue and says it'll hold a nationwide strike over economic woes. The UGTT says it will not take part in an advisory committee set up by President Kais Saied to discuss political and economic reforms. The union says it rejects any dialogue where rules are unilaterally determined. Last week, Saied designated a law professor to head the Committee of Legal and Political Science Experts to draft a new constitution. He, however, barred political parties from any role in the process. The main opposition party, Ennahda, has also rejected Saied's move, saying it lacks constitutional legitimacy. Tunisia has been in a deep political crisis since June 2021, when Saied dismissed the government, suspended parliament, and assumed executive authority. The president's opponents accuse him of a coup. The U.S. Defense Secretary says some 20 countries have announced new military assistance packages to help Ukraine in its war with Russia. Lloyd Austin says many countries are donating artillery ammunition, coastal defense systems, and armored vehicles, including tanks, to Ukraine. Others, he said, have committed to training Ukraine's forces and maintaining its military systems. He made the announcement following a virtual meeting of the so-called Ukraine Defense Contact Group. Austin said the countries that announced new packages for Ukraine included Italy, Denmark, Greece, Norway, and Poland. The U.S. and the EU have provided Ukraine with $5.5 billion in military support since Russia launched the war against its neighbor in late February. Russia has warned the U.S. and its allies over their military support for Ukraine, saying the move prolongs the conflict. It's already targeted several Western arms shipments in Ukraine. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says he is willing to meet his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin to discuss how to end the war. Addressing the World Economic Forum in Davos by video link, Zelensky said Putin is the only Russian official he'd accept to meet, but only to discuss, quote, stopping the war. The Ukrainian president, however, said arranging talks with Russia was becoming increasingly difficult. He said the reason was evidence of what he called Russian violence against civilians. Moscow has vehemently denied targeting civilians in Ukraine. Russia's lead negotiator said on Sunday that Moscow was prepared to resume peace talks with Kiev. He added that it was Ukraine's initiative to halt the negotiations in the first place. Our correspondent in eastern Ukraine, Johnny Miller, reports from the Donbass region to find people who no longer wish to be a part of Ukraine. Here's more.
Donetsk, the capital of the Donbass People's Republic, on a sleepy Sunday morning. The front line is only 6 kilometers away. The occasional boom of artillery or anti-air defense can be heard.
People think it's normal in the DPR, but we have no more patience to wait until it ends, to live under bombing. All my relatives and I are sometimes under shelling. Once a shell flew over my head and killed a woman nearby. It's possible to live here. I was born here, and I suppose I will die here too.
Most of the people on the streets are women. Since Russia entered the conflict, conscription was introduced here. And while the DPR militias have majority support, I've heard of some men who stay in their apartments 24/7 so as not to be forced to join.
Now, to my knowledge, there are no English-speaking mainstream journalists here in Russian-held Ukraine. I think there's a French, a German, an Italian, but that's about it. So in terms of journalists from NATO countries, there's almost none. And the problem with that is that people living in NATO countries simply don't hear the views of people here in Donetsk.
The first thing I would like to say is that the DPR exists because we are free people. We want our own opinions, our own independence and our own views of the world, not the viewpoint that someone imposes on us. So we are defending our interests. That's why the DPR exists.
The majority of people here are Russian speakers with a proud Russian culture. A bust of Pushkin, the famous Russian poet, stands outside the drama theatre. And in the main square, Lenin.
In 2014, I was in Kiev covering the Ukrainian revolution or coup, whatever you want to call it, where I witnessed the pulling down of a statue of Lenin by Ukrainian nationalists. Now, if the Donetsk People's Republic didn't exert control in this area, this statue here most probably would have been pulled down by Ukrainian nationalists as well. And it's statues like this, symbolic statues like this, that are important to people's culture here.
Since the nationalistic Ukrainian government took power in Kiev in 2014, they have attempted to impose their agenda on the majority Russian areas, pulling down statues and forcing institutions to drop Russian as an official language. There has also been the killing of dozens of pro-Russian activists. This is what led to Donbass rising up and attempting to create a breakaway state.
Certainly the rights of the Russian-speaking population were stomped on. There were demands that we should speak Ukrainian and not Russian, and all administration procedures were changed to Ukrainian. I think that any culture should be looked after and passed on to young people. It's very important because young people cannot grow up without their culture. There cannot be any people without their culture.
Of course I was born here. This is my land. I studied here at the Institute. We studied both Russian and Ukrainian. It was normal. And when they started to kill us, we couldn't understand how it could happen, how people can treat their compatriots like this. We are constantly being killed from morning to night here.
The flags of Donbass and Russia side by side. While at first demanding autonomy, since the war, they are adamant they want to be independent or to join Russia. President Zelensky recently said that negotiations are the only way to end this conflict. If lasting peace is to be made, the rights, culture and wishes of the 4 million people here in Donbass need to be taken into account. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
Tensions once again escalate between the U.S. and China over Taiwan. Beijing has warned Washington that there is no room for compromise and concessions over the self-ruled island. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman called on the U.S. to earnestly abide by the One China principle and refrain from supporting Taiwan's independence. The Taiwan Affairs Office of the State Council of China also warned the U.S. against playing with fire. The reactions came after U.S. President Joe Biden said Washington would defend Taiwan militarily if Beijing invaded it. However, the U.S. Defense Secretary says Biden's comments did not amount to a shift in America's policy on military assistance to Taiwan. Lloyd Austin says Washington's One China policy toward the island has not changed. China considers Taiwan as part of its territory.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends, no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
Liberation of Khurramshah, Day of Resistance, Self-Sacrifice, and Victory. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. May 24th is the day of liberation of the port city of Khurramshahr, in the southwest of Iran. It took place in 1982 during the eight-year war that the United States and its accomplices had imposed on Iran through their stooge in the region, Saddam of the Ba'ath regime. The day has been named as the Day of Resistance, Self-Sacrifice, and Victory in the Islamic Republic of Iran calendar. Stay tuned for a special feature on this occasion. The history of Iran's holy defense against the Ba'athist eight-year invasion was full of great days whose glory has remained indelibly in the minds of the Iranian nation. However, May 24th is among the greatest and brightest days of the holy defense as it was a turning point in the war and changed the equations of the war against the initiator of the war and his Western and Eastern masters and regional supporters. Khorramshahr is a strategic port in Khuzestan province, southwest of Iran. It is located on the confluence of the two rivers, Karun and Arvand. The city was occupied by Saddam's army on October 26, 1980, after 35 exemplary resistance of young Iranian combatants and ordinary people of the city. Khorramshahr was liberated after 578 days on May 24, 1982, in an honorable operation. The operation was carried out jointly by the Iranian army and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC. The liberation of Khorramshahr was the most important phase of Beit al-Muqaddas, which included four phases. The stiff battle terminated 19 months of the occupation of the strategic port and dealt a very deadly blow to the war machine of Saddam and the morale of Iraqi invading forces. The liberation of Khorramshahr was considered as a prelude to the fall of Basra. As a matter of fact, the Iraqi dictator Saddam had arrogantly said, "If Iranians retake Khorramshahr, I will give them the key to Basra." However, the Iranian brave combatants smashed the Iraqi fortifications and positions just to astound military experts in the world. Nearly 16,000 enemy forces were killed and injured. More than 19,000 others were taken captive by the Iranian forces. After liberation of the strategic port city of Khorramshahr, the Iranian youth performed prayer at the main mosque of the city known as Masjid-e-Jame. The news of this great victory was soon spread across Iran and made the whole nation happy. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, issued a message in part of which he said, "I am thankful for the telegraphs sent to me on the liberation of Khorramshahr. Unlimited gratitude should be expressed to Almighty God who has helped and supported the Islamic country and devoted and selfless combatants and granted us his great victory." Elsewhere in his message, the Imam said, "It is God who liberated Khorramshahr." Imam Khomeini, in fact, meant to teach a lesson to the Iranian combatants and nation not to fall in the vanity to think that they had gained victory without God's help. Anyway, the liberation of Khorramshahr taught Saddam and his Western and Eastern masters and his supporters among the reactionary Arab regimes not to think of another invasion of the Iranian territory and values. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said on the liberation of Khorramshahr, "When our armed forces started their move with prudence, sharp-sightedness, willpower stemming from faith, trust in God, using all facilities so that they didn't let the least thing be wasted, and relying on their power and trusting in Almighty God, no one in the world believed that they could liberate Khorramshahr. But they succeeded. When we announced that we had retaken Khorramshahr, the news agencies of the world were not intent to release the news looking at it doubtfully, but this occurred, and in the end, everyone was forced to admit this victory. The city of Khorramshahr was liberated, and it turned into the unforgettable memory of unity, resistance, and victory of the Iranian nation. It is a lesson to mankind that God supports and helps the oppressed and those who have been kept weak and inferior. It has inspired hope among poor nations to stand against tyranny and oppression till ultimate victory."
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Declassified. Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The murder of Shireen Abu Akleh by an Israeli sniper has shocked the world. Her death and the horrifying attack on the mourners at her funeral have even been condemned by governments that staunchly support the temporary entity. Today, we'll look at Shireen's murder and how it's yet another example of the ongoing onslaught against journalists by the Zionist regime. Later in the show, we'll look at how Zionist propagandists work closely with pro-Israel journalists to distort how the world views Palestine. As always, I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more. But first, we've got this special report by Bianca Rahimi on Shireen's murder.
Israel is at war with journalism. Following the horrific killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, which sent reverberations around the world, it is vital we examine some of the less obvious ways in which the temporary Zionist entity fights against exposure of the facts. Shireen Abu Akleh is a name which will echo through the ages, but her name is merely the latest in a long list of clearly identified journalists whose lives were cut short by the Israeli regime. Names like Yasser Murtaja, Ahmed Abu Hussein, Basil Faraj, Fadel Shana, Imad Abu Zahra, Issam Tilawi, James Miller, Khalid Riyad Hamad, Mahmoud Al-Kumi, and Nazih Darwaza should also be remembered. They all wore clothing identifying themselves as press, and all were killed by the temporary entity. The Palestinian Journalists Union says 55 journalists have been killed by Zionists since the year 2000. Since 2018, at least 144 Palestinian journalists have been wounded by Zionist forces across the Gaza Strip, West Bank and East Jerusalem, hurt by live fire and rubber bullets, as well as stun grenades, tear gas, beatings with batons, according to Reporters Without Borders. Another way in which the Israeli regime expresses its disdain for the reporting of truth is through its insistence on prosecuting Palestinian journalists on the charge of incitement. Between 2015 and 2018, over 500 Palestinians were arrested by the Israeli regime for the crime of incitement for things they posted online. Many were journalists and some were children. Currently, there are more than 15 Palestinian journalists languishing in occupation jails for so-called incitement. Some are being held under administrative detention. The Israeli NSO group has exported its Pegasus spyware around the world, hacking into phones of thousands of activists and journalists in many different countries. It was claimed by the organization that it had no access to the information its spyware was hacking for other regimes. However, that would fail to explain how NSO advisory board member Sherry Blair was able to inform the ex-wife of Dubai's ruler that she was a target of her former husband. If the NSO group does not have access to this information, how could Sherry Blair possibly know? The shocking Zionist police attack on the funeral of Shirin Abu Akhla reminds us that none of this behavior is new to Zionist occupation forces. Apartheid troops shot dead Shawkat Khalil Awad at the funeral of Muhammad al-Alama, a child they shot dead the night before in 2021. And there have been many other examples of Palestinian funerals coming under violent assault. So here we have a pariah regime, rejected by much of the world, which engages in constant covert and overt war against any journalist seeking to reveal the truth about its actions. Long live the martyr, Shirin Abu Akhla. Long live adversarial journalism.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative Spinwatch. We're also joined by Mona Kandil. Mona is a Ramallah correspondent for Press TV. Being a journalist in occupied Palestine is not easy, and many times Mona's had to remove her Press TV logo from her mic while covering demonstrations and clashes in Al-Quds. The most difficult is the protests ending up with confrontations between Israeli forces and Palestinian protesters. The challenge for her, then, is to cover a story and return home safe and sound. Mona was born in Lebanon and grew up in Saida City. She also lived in Algeria and Syria before returning to Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Mona joins us today from Ramallah. Welcome to the show. Mona, I wonder if we could get you up on the screen, if we could perhaps start with you, if I may. I mean, the situation in the West Bank since Shireen's murder, I mean, we've seen many outrages in recent weeks. I wonder if you could give us a feel about the situation and what the atmosphere is actually like there right now.
Well, we have to say that Israeli aggression, Israeli violence against the Palestinians have been escalating even, let's say, with the start of the holy month of Ramadan and mainly on Fridays of the holy month of Ramadan. However, when Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akhla was murdered by Israeli soldiers in cold blood in Jenin, as everyone watched her killing in Jenin last week, since then, and the Israeli soldiers had been really outraged. On the one hand, they killed a Palestinian journalist on cold blood, and on the other hand, they don't want for the Palestinians to confront the Israelis, to express their anger, to demand for bringing the Israeli soldiers who were behind the killing of Shirin Abu Akhla and to prosecute them. This is very weird for the whole world. First of all, Israeli soldiers in Jenin killed Shireen Abu Akleh while she was wearing her flak jacket. It was clearly written on its breast. And she was also putting her helmet as well. Before her death, another Palestinian journalist, Ali Samoudi, was shot and wounded. And he tried to worry the other journalists there, Shireen Abu Akleh, and another female journalist, Shada, in order to take care. But however, they couldn't. They tried to shelter themselves to return back to a wall that was next to a tree. They were close to the Israeli soldiers, but at the same time, there were no Palestinian protesters, no Palestinian fighters, no Palestinian citizens around them. So there were only a group of journalists, Palestinian cameramen trying to shoot the Israeli military incursion to Jenin, and then there were the Israeli soldiers opening their fire towards those Palestinian journalists, Israeli soldiers, of course. Everyone also saw when a Palestinian man tried to pull the body of Shireen Abu Akleh. Israeli soldiers didn't stop. They continued to fire towards those Palestinian journalists. So it's a murder. It's an assassination. We're not saying the Israeli soldiers' acts and aggression and crimes are saying that it's an assassination of Shireen Abu Akleh. The escalation continued because it was a shock, not only for Palestinian journalists. We have to mention that Shireen Abu Akleh is a well-known Palestinian journalist because she works with an Arab channel that, let's say, the Arab people here in Palestine follow, of course, the Arab channels, not the English channels, let's say. And she was working for Al Jazeera for over 20 years. She covered the Israeli, the Intifada. She covered the Israeli raid to Jenin almost 20 years ago. So many of them considered that by killing Shireen Abu Akleh, the Israeli forces had killed a sister of every Palestinian, also killed a friend of their childhood. This is why it was very difficult on them. And this continued to anger the Israeli military, of course.
Yeah. I mean, David, the scenes from Jenin, I mean, absolutely shocking. And, you know, the monstrous attack on the mourners at Shireen's funeral, I don't think I've seen anything quite like that. I mean, what's your take on the situation?
Well, I mean, it looks like that the Israelis simply cannot tolerate any sign of resistance. Mm-hmm. So one of the things they objected to, it appears, in the funeral, was the appearance of Palestinian flags. And they had said in advance, you can't have Palestinian flags, you can't have chanting. And then, of course, when they attacked the funeral, they said later, well, it was because there were stones being thrown and there were rioters, and we attacked the rioters. Well, no, the people were the pallbearers they attacked. They weren't rioting, they weren't throwing stones. The footage clearly shows that. What they can't stand is any sign of resistance, of a proud, resistant people. And the Palestinian flags is one of those signs. And you see footage across the West Bank of them trying to remove Palestinian flags from demonstrators, etc., because they can't bear the sign of resistance. I think it betrays, though, a certain insecurity amongst Zionist forces themselves, the police, the military, and also the settlers. A certain insecurity which has been expressed even by the defence minister, Benny Gantz, the other day when he said, you know, it's not very clear that we can still be here in a few years' time. We might have to constrict the state of Israel to a small portion in the middle around about Tel Aviv. Mm-hmm. So they are worried, and that's what leads to the ultra-violent expressions against Shireen Abu Akleh's funeral and indeed other incidents.
Yeah. Mona, how on earth do journalists operate in such an oppressive environment as that?
Well, let's say the most important thing is that to tell the truth, to cover the Israeli crimes, but also to try to return home safe and sound. And this is not difficult and not easy for Palestinians, of course, because the Israeli soldiers do not differentiate between Palestinian journalists or Palestinian protesters. All of them are considered Palestinians. It's not the first incident when a Palestinian journalist is killed. 50 Palestinian journalists have been shot dead by the Israeli forces since 2000 up till the moment. A number of Palestinians Palestinian journalists have been detained by the Israeli forces. Also, expressing your thoughts over social media, of course, is prohibited. You would be arrested and questioned by the Israeli soldiers anytime. Palestinian journalists continue to face the same destiny of the normal people here. When we covered the protests and demonstrations, numerous times we had been attacked by the Israeli soldiers, suffer suffocation due to inhaling the tear gas. Me, myself, I had to stay in hospital for almost 24 hours because of the heavy tear gas that was fired by Israeli soldiers in the last protest almost 3 years ago. It was a different of tear gas that caused not only suffocation, but long side effects. So the Palestinian journalists try their utmost in order to cover what's going on, but at the same time, make sure that we are safe. However, the Israeli soldiers do not differentiate between the journalists and the protesters. In addition to this, working with any channel that the Israelis consider their enemy, it's not only press TV, we have to say this, any international channel or international TV would be considered by the Israeli regime as their enemy. They don't want for the journalists to expose their crimes, to tell the world what's really going on. They want to kill the people, arrest people, demolish Palestinians' homes, annex the lands and seize more lands, of course, expand illegal settlements. And at the same time, they don't want for anyone to expose their crimes or to tell the world and the international community, let's say, what's going on. They continue to act as a state above the law, knowing that at the end of the day, there would be no accountability. Their soldiers, would be would have the impunity, and no one would drag them to the international criminal court.
We're going to have to just move on to the next item now, Mona, if that's okay. How the influence which is being put upon the media to actually, you know, give a distorted position in relation to the reporting and indeed what's actually happening on the ground in Palestine.
Western media try their best not to tell the truth about Palestine. The double standard on Palestine and Ukraine has been pointed out by many. The same is said about the reluctance to use active words like killed, executed or murdered for the killing of the Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akla. Al Jazeera journalists, colleagues of Shireen Abu Akla, expressed outrage at the murderous activities of Zionist forces. Two argued that the network should no longer allow apologists for Israel to appear on the channel. Algerian journalist Khadija Ben Genna, with 2 million Twitter followers, called on Al Jazeera to boycott Israeli guests. Ahmed Mansour, host at Al Jazeera Media Network, with 1.3 million Twitter followers, added his voice, demanding that Al Jazeera Arabic stop hosting the Israeli killers on its screens or whoever represents them. This would certainly have an impact on media coverage of the conflict, especially if it was not confined to Al Jazeera's Arabic service. It's well known that Zionist propagandists are able to exert significant influence on media agendas. But who are the propagandists? And would their removal be enough to cleanse the media of propaganda for murder and war crimes? The propaganda or Hasbara apparatus of the Zionist state centrally involves the so-called IDF Spokespersons Unit, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and until recently, the Ministry of Strategic Affairs, all coordinated by the Public Diplomacy Directorate in the Prime Minister's office. In early 2022, this effort was relaunched with a renewed commitment to funding a vast covert network of proxies and front groups. Some of this is coordinated via something called the Coalition of Hasbara Volunteers, including groups based all over the world, including many explicitly Zionist groups, as well as PR fronts like BICOM, Stand With Us or We Believe in Israel in the UK, and Camera or Honest Reporting in the US. Banning Zionist Hasbara officials and their PR and lobby front groups would help more of the truth to emerge from Palestine. But we would still have to deal with the problem of direct Zionist influence in the media. There are many thousands of journalists working in Western news organizations who are partisans of Zionism, many of them having current or former membership of Zionist organizations or Israel lobby groups. In the UK, for example, Alex Brummer is the city editor for the Daily Mail, as well as being the chair of the State of Israel-funded Abraham Initiatives. Jonathan Friedland is a senior columnist at The Guardian and was a member for the Zionist youth group Habonim Dror, as was BBC presenter Emma Barnett. There are hundreds more. The task ahead is to steadily degrade the number of Zionist assets working in the Western media, allowing independent, indeed liberation journalism, more of a chance.
David, what do you make of the suggestion that, you know, kind of removes Zionists, you know, from the news? Is that a kind of a practical proposition?
Well, it sort of sounds unfeasible and unreasonable. But if you think about the flip side of this, you know, in the last 20 or 30 years where there are military conflicts, Western governments, including those of Israel and the US and the UK, have managed to almost entirely exclude those who support armed violence against the West. Terrorists, they're called. So it's not impractical for Western media to remove Zionists from spokespersons from the news. It just requires the political consensus and pressure to do so. So it's not an impossible thing to do. But it would be something which would be very difficult in the current political circumstances. The political circumstances have to change in order to do that. But I think we need to think of this as something which is part of a process of reconceptualizing what's happening in Palestine and trying to push back so that it's possible for the truth to be told.
I mean, in the previous clip, we heard about the NSO group and they're claiming that can't get access to this sort of Pegasus information. But how is it then, do you think? I mean, maybe you could comment on that. I know it sort of mentioned it in the package there about Sherry Blair reaching out to the wife of the leader in Dubai. I mean, what do you make? It's a bit odd, isn't it? I mean, what do you make of that? I mean, can you say a little bit about that?
Well, we have quite a number of different high-tech firms. The NSO group is only one of them. It's the most well-known because there's been the most cases about it, which come directly or indirectly from the Israeli intelligence organisations. So they are organisations which effectively have some kind of intelligence backdoor and are used as instruments of foreign policy by, for example, the Israeli state. So this is a mechanism by which effectively a foreign intelligence agency can monitor journalists, activists all around the world and use that to their own advantage. In the case of Sherry Blair, it's odd, isn't it? I mean, the owners of this company say, we don't know what people are using our software for. We only give it to certain governments. We don't know what they're using it for. But yet, nevertheless, Sherry Blair, who had this connection with the NSO group, was able to reveal to this former royal that she was being surveilled by her ex-husband. So there's something very, very dodgy about that, isn't there? Mm. And there needs to be much more investigation of organisations like the NSO group and other similar organisations.
Yeah. Mona, perhaps we'll get Mona back on the screen again. I wonder whether you could say a little bit about, I mean, what the mechanisms that are used to ensure that Palestinian views are not heard by a global audience, you know, the truth about Palestine.
Well, it's all Palestinian journalists here do their utmost. But maybe the Israeli authorities, Israeli occupation authorities, try their utmost to tell the word that what they do would be a reaction on the Palestinian so-called terrorists. But what's going on really here in the occupied territories is that it's really a crimes and aggression being committed by the Israeli forces. It's not about only occupying a territory and that leaving them alone to live in that territory. No, Israeli aggression and violence, Israeli crimes continue to be committed. That's why Palestinian journalists are doing their utmost to tell the world what's going on. But at the end of the day, it will not be enough for them, because Western, let's say, media have a role as well, is to tell their people what's really going on, to tell their people that what's going on is Israeli aggression, Israeli military occupation. Palestinians are not living normal life here in the occupied territories. Palestinians are not terrorists. When a Palestinian is being killed at the checkpoints or near Israeli settlements, they have to tell the truth that in many cases, Palestinians were shot dead in cold blood just because the Israeli soldiers had been standing or near the illegal settlements or at the checkpoints, and they thought those Palestinians were suspicious for the Israeli soldiers. That's why they were killed. And then the Israelis tried to tell the world that this Palestinian or another had a knife, and they tried to attack the Israeli soldiers. So journalists have a very important role to tell the truth, to expose the Israeli lies, of course, and to speak to the international world and to the Western countries to tell the truth that Palestinians are living under occupation and the Israelis continue to speak to the world.
Mona, if I just wanted to ask David one brief question. You talked about how journalists have been incarcerated. We know that many Palestinians and journalists are routinely incarcerated. It's kind of mass incarceration. I mean, what do you make of that? I mean, it's quite shocking, isn't it?
Of course, it's shocking. It's one of the many shocking things. So, as has been said, more than 50 journalists killed in the last 20 years. And the stunning numbers of journalists in prison for incitement, for things like posting on Facebook or on Twitter. And that's a mechanism which is used against Palestinian citizens in general, and indeed also against journalists. And posting on Facebook of support for opposition to Zionism, or indeed just poetry, which isn't consonant with Zionist views. So there's a huge attempt to try and to squelch the possibility of the expression of opposition to Zionism.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid, again, we've run out of time, sadly, so we're going to have to leave it there. But thank you very much indeed for joining us. And we'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
In the Limelight.
A global index published recently ranks the United States as the world's leading perpetrator of the financial secrecy, citing the country's refusal to share key information with the tax authorities of other nations and its status as a generous tax haven for foreign oligarchs, rich executives, and other elites. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, A Shameful Distinction. U.S. ranked world's biggest perpetrator of financial secrecy. Here's the story. A global index published recently ranks the United States as the world's leading perpetrator of financial secrecy, citing the country's refusal to share key information with the tax authorities of other nations and its status as a generous tax haven for foreign oligarchs, rich executives, and other elites. The ranking comes despite U.S. President Joe Biden's campaign trail pledge to bring transparency to the global financial system, go after illicit tax havens, seize stolen assets, and make it more difficult for leaders who steal from their people to hide behind anonymous front companies. In December, following the leak of an enormous trove of tax documents that called additional attention to the country's secretive financial system, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen conceded, "There is a good argument that right now the best place to hide and launder ill-gotten gains is actually the United States." The latest edition of the Financial Secrecy Index, a project of the Tax Justice Network, or TJN, echoes that assessment, faulting the U.S. for its weak corporate tax disclosure rules and overall lack of transparency. In fact, the index awarded the U.S. the highest secrecy score since 2009 when the ranking began. That isn't a prize the U.S. wants to claim for itself, Gary Coleman, the executive director of Transparency International U.S., said in a statement, adding, "The combination of secrecy and size of our financial system puts the U.S. ahead of other notorious secrecy havens like the Cayman Islands and Switzerland. That's a shameful distinction." While noting that some progress has been made over the past year and a half, specifically Congress's passage of a ban on anonymous shell companies, entities often used to hide illicit cash, TJN found that the U.S. now fuels more global financial secrecy than Switzerland, Cayman, and Bermuda combined. TJN also stressed that the shell company law enacted in January 2021 is riddled with loopholes such as limited definitions of which legal entities and beneficial owners must register, 23 baked-in exemptions to registration, and an absence of requirements on all trusts. To improve on this